is helping to plan the Liberalia a few days from now.
Really?
Papa, do you pay no attention to what's going on under your own roof?
I am aware that Bethesda and Diana have been going to meetings at Thalia's house, I said, with a vague wave of my hand.
And thanks to Caesar and Cicero and you, I've had more important things on my mind.
As we passed the crowds along the route, men and women gawked at Caesar in his golden litter, and many called out his name, as we in his retinue had done before we set out. "Hail Caesar!" they would cry, waving to the dictator and then shouting his name again if he saw them and waved back. Some ran towards Caesar, reaching past stern-faced lictors to hand him bits of folded parchment. Caesar made a show of reaching out to accept each of these written requests for favours. He collected them all in his left hand, keeping his right hand free to wave to the crowd or reach out to accept more bits of parchment. As we were going down a particularly narrow street of ramshackle tenements, "Hail Caesar!" cried a figure leaning from an upper-story window. The man who looked down at us had long, unkempt hair, a scarred face, and a patch over one eye. "Go show the Parthians!" he cried, shaking his fist. "Show them what Romans are made of, the way we showed those Edui up in Gaul." Caesar leaned out of his litter to peer up at the man, then signalled to the bearers to stop. "You were with me when we laid siege to Bibracte?" he asked.
"That I was, Imperator. The day we breached the walls, I killed 50 men and raped a dozen boys while I was at it."
He laughed harshly.
"But I did pay a price."
He pointed to his eye patch and then inserted his thumb into his mouth and made a popping noise, as if to replicate the sound of an eye plucked from its socket. Caesar stared up at him.
"Yes, I remember you," he said. "Marcus Artorius, centurion of the 7th Legion."
The man's disfigured face lit up.
"That I am, Imperator, or was, and you remember me after all this time. Imagine that.
I don't forget a citizen who served bravely in a distant land, fighting for Rome.
Fighting for you, Caesar.
How are you faring now?" The man's smile faded.
"Not so well as I might, Imperator. Fallen on hard times. No one's fault but my own. Spent all my booty on boys and wine, just to kill the pain, you see."
He grimaced and raised his left arm to gesture at his scarred face, I thought, until I saw there was no hand at the end of the arm.
"That won't do," said Caesar. He summoned a nearby scribe and spoke in the slave's ear. The scribe nodded and then stepped into the building. "I'm sending a fellow up to see you," Caesar continued. "He'll take down your name and some other details, and I shall see that you are properly cared for from now on. A man who's made the sacrifices you've made for Rome should never go hungry."
"Or thirsty," said the man, and laughed. Caesar smiled up at him, then gave him a wave and signalled the litter to move on. I turned to Mito. Caesar actually remembered the man's name out of all the thousands of soldiers he commanded. No wonder everyone calls him such a great leader. Mito flashed a crooked smile.
"It's a bit of a trick."
"What do you mean?"
"Of course, you're impressed that Caesar remembers such an insignificant fellow, and it is remarkable that Caesar can hold so many names and faces in his head. But if he hadn't recognized the fellow, which is much more often the case, he'd simply have waved and nodded to the man and moved on, and you'd have thought no more of it. But since he did recognize the man and remembered his name, Caesar put on a bit of a show, knowing how much that sort of thing impresses those who witness it.
He did this virtually every day when we were fighting in Gaul, recognizing soldiers and calling them by name. He had me make a note. When you see a man whose name you remember, demonstrate it, and all the many whose names you've forgotten will assume that you remember them as well. Good advice, whether in the field fighting Gauls or fishing for votes in the forum.
I don't remember reading that in his war journal.
It was edited out, said Mito with a laugh. Then he wrinkled his brow. Good advice, whether in the field fighting Gauls or fishing for votes in the forum, he repeated. But of course, votes and voters don't really matter any more, do they?
Not once a man is dictator for life, I said.
But old habits die hard. Caesar took advantage of that chance meeting as if by reflex. I would never have remembered the man, and I'll have forgotten him in an hour. But we'll both remember that Caesar greeted him by name, honored his service, and rewarded his sacrifice. Even a dictator must give the people reasons to love him. And you have more reason than most, Papa. I suddenly felt ill at ease in my borrowed toga. No voters had ever elected me a magistrate, and thus set me on the course of honour with a place in the Senate. The honour of wearing a senator's toga had been bestowed on me by one man. I owed the voters of Rome nothing. What did I owe to Caesar? What did all the other appointed senators owe him? How and when might he call in the debt? We entered a wider street and continued past the newer tenements and marketplaces of the Field of Mars, until at last the Theatre of Pompey loomed before us. The wing of the structure in which we would meet was still called the Senate House of Pompey, despite the Great One's defeat in the Civil War and his ignominious death. When Pompey, at the peak of his career, decided to erect a gigantic theatre on the Field of Mars, the first permanent, purpose-built theatre ever to be constructed in Rome, to satisfy old-timers with religious objections, he added a temple to Venus at the top, above the last row of seats, and to bring in some rental income, he also added a sprawling portico with shops and warehouses, and, since there was still marble in the quarry, he also constructed a chamber built specifically for meetings of the Roman Senate, all of which he named for himself. The Theatre of Pompey, the Portico of Pompey, the Senate House of Pompey. As the Capitoline Hill dominated the city of Rome, so the vast, towering complex erected by Pompey dominated the Field of Mars. As we drew closer to the theatre, I heard a roar from within. At first, I thought the cheering must be for Caesar. Then I remembered that a gladiator show was being presented that day, with the combats and killing to take place on the stage. Apparently, the programme was already underway. A gladiator show on the festival of Anna Perenna, I remarked, and from the sound of it, the theatre is packed. Who would want to watch gladiators hack each other to death on such a fine spring morning? I sighed. I suppose those of us too old, or too married, or too chaste, or too sober to celebrate Anna Perenna, can enjoy a bit of bloodshed instead. That's Rome, something for everyone, said Mito with a grin. How happy he was that day, walking beside his father in Caesar's entourage. We rounded a corner and passed by one of the main entrances to the theatre. I saw a great many gladiators milling about. None of them appeared to be handling swords or tridents, but some were wearing armour, and all looked restless and surly. Why all those gladiators outside the theatre instead of inside? Even as I asked, I saw Decimus leave Caesar's side and walk to the man evidently in charge of the gladiator troop. Decimus, looking quite serious, appeared to be giving the man instructions.
"I think those gladiators are owned by Decimus," said Mito. "There's some dispute between him and the presenter of today's show about a valuable gladiator who's stolen or lured away. I suspect Decimus's men are here to take back his property, by force, if necessary."
"What if a brawl breaks out?" I said.
"Then the audience will get more bloodshed than they bargain for."
Decimus finished talking to the man in charge of his gladiators, then hurried to catch up with Caesar's litter. Caesar, glancing at the gladiators, appeared to ask a question, and Decimus appeared to answer. "Caesar probably wishes he were attending the gladiator show today, instead of addressing the Senate," said Mito.
"What an appetite our dictator has for bloodshed and suffering," I thought. "What a connoisseur he is of all manner of mayhem and death. And now he is about to head for Parthia, to unleash untold havoc in a whole other part of the world, carnage and destruction on an unimaginable scale." But all I said to Mito was, "I, for one, have no wish to see blood shed today." Looking back at Decimus's gladiators, I felt suddenly apprehensive. I was merely nervous, I thought, as any man would be on the day he was to stand before the Senate and give a speech, however simple and brief, with the likes of Cicero and Caesar watching and listening to every word.
Chapter 33. We arrived at the large courtyard outside the Senate House of Pompey. Crowds of senators milled about, some standing on the broad steps leading up to the building's entrance. Many hailed Caesar, others kept their mouths shut. Some looked restless and bored after waiting hours for Caesar to arrive. Cicero, standing on the steps and attended by Tiro, looked particularly petulant. Side by side, Brutus and Cassius were pacing back and forth at the top of the steps. They looked especially uneasy, but also relieved, I thought, like men who had pressing business to attend to, and now, with Caesar's arrival, could at last get on with it. Antony, with a smile on his face, came striding down the steps to meet Caesar as he stepped from his litter. "So, you decided to come after all," I heard him say. "Very good. As soon as we've taken the auspices, we can all get to work." On a raised platform at the foot of the steps, Spurinna stood before a large stone altar. There are also a number of priests holding ceremonial knives for slaughtering and cutting open sacrificial animals. As presiding Haruspex, Spurinna would examine the entrails and determine whether the auspices were good or bad for the Senate to meet on this day. If necessary, more than one animal might be sacrificed. Amid the throng of togas in the courtyard, I caught a glimpse of the pens in which they were kept and heard the bleating of goats. Caesar strode through the crowd of senators and mounted the raised platform, facing Spurinna across the altar. Mito and I stood in the crowd behind Caesar, so that I could clearly see the face of Spurinna on the opposite side. As Pontifex Maximus, it was up to Caesar to signal that the taking of auspices could begin. He raised his hand and nodded. A goat was brought forth on a leash held by a priest. The animal willingly stepped onto the dais, a good sign. The priests proceeded to bind the animal's legs and lift it onto the altar. The goat bleated loudly, but kicked and struggled only a little, another good sign. The more willingly the animal meets its death, the more likely the auspices will be good. Caesar nodded approvingly. One of the priests raised a knife high in the air, recited a prayer, then deftly cut the goat's throat. The animal convulsed. Priests twisted the goat's head to one side so that channels carved into the altar would carry off the spurting blood. The animal's legs were quickly unbound, each taking hold of a trembling foreleg and a hind leg. Two priests exposed the goat's underside, allowing Spirinna, at the exact moment of death, to slice the goat open from the base of its throat to its navel. Spirinna put aside his knife and peered at the exposed entrails. He frowned. He shook his head. He grunted. "By Jupiter, man, what is it?" demanded Caesar.
"Dictator, part of the liver is missing, and the colour of the viscera around the heart is abnormal. There's a greenish tinge."
"What of it?"
"Dictator, the omen isn't good. It's not good at all. Any deformity of the liver speaks of danger. Green viscera, too, signals a threat."
"Spirinna, I'm not having this," said Caesar, leaning forward and speaking so quietly that I heard him only because every senator around us was completely silent, as we all held our breath.
"Dictator, I can only report what I observe."
"Bring forth another sacrifice," said Caesar, raising his voice. The operation was repeated. This time, Spirinna observed a knot in the bowels that indicated aborted plans and disappointments. Caesar was again displeased. Another goat was brought forth. Perhaps, alerted by the smell of blood and the bleating of the previous sacrifices, this one struggled at every stage, refusing to step onto the dais so vigorously that it almost escaped, then kicking and thrashing as its legs were bound, then twisting so violently that the priest charged with killing it had to make not one, but two cuts with his knife. As the animal died, Spirinna stepped back and lowered his knife.
"Dictator, the resistance of the sacrifice speaks for itself. There's no need to cut it open. I can already tell you—"
"You will say not another word, Haruspex," said Caesar, in a tone I had never heard from him before. Spirinna shut his mouth and trembled, as if a chill wind blew over him. Caesar instructed the priest to untie the goat and take it away. He looked at the silent, grim-faced senators gathered in the courtyard and on the steps. He smiled. "Something very similar happened in Spain, when I was about to engage with Pompey's forces there. Three goats were said by the Haruspex to be unfit, all three ill-omened. Do you know what happened? I went into battle anyway, and on to victory. Had I listened to the Haruspex that day, it would be Pompey standing here instead of me. The auspices can be very difficult to interpret. Even the most experienced Haruspex—" here he looked at Spirinna— "even the most experienced Haruspex can be mistaken. As Pontifex Maximus, I declare the taking of these auspices to be inconclusive. The will of the gods can't be clearly discerned. In light of the importance of this meeting, we shall proceed." The senators began moving across the courtyard and up the steps. Caesar lowered his voice. "Now, lend me your arm," he said to Decimus, who was standing nearest, "while I step down from the platform. The last thing we need now is a misstep." He smiled to make light of the moment, but Decimus looked very serious as he helped Caesar descend. With Antony on his right and Decimus on his left, Caesar headed for the steps. He looked over his shoulder. "Stay close by me,
Gordianus, I shall tend to your induction early on, so that you can join in the voting right away. There was a fluttering in my chest. My heart lurched into my throat. In a matter of minutes, I would be standing before the Senate, having to speak. My mouth was dry, and I felt light-headed. I was also hot, so hot I thought I might faint, despite the thinness of Cinna's summer toga.
"Papa, you all right?" said Mito.
"What, me? Of course I am."
"Papa, I don't know if I've ever seen you like this. You mustn't worry. Everything will go smoothly, I'm sure. Caesar knows what he's doing."
"Yes, I'm sure he does."
"If only I could be there with you. But only senators are allowed in the chamber during meetings. Well, senators and a handful of secretaries and official scribes, like Cicero's man, Tyro."
I was to be on my own, then, in a room full of the most powerful men on earth, some of whose darkest secrets were known to me from past investigations. Some of those men liked me, perhaps. Some loathed me, I was certain. Would a single one of them welcome me as an equal, even at Caesar's behest?
"Where will you go, Mito?"
He shrugged. I knew he was trying to behave as nonchalantly as possible for my sake.
"Perhaps I'll sneak into the gladiator show. Yes, I just might. Even if you have no taste for it, Papa, I enjoy seeing a bit of bloodshed now and then. Why not today?"
Midway up the steps, Caesar stopped and turned back. "Mito, here, take these." He thrust out his left hand, in which he clutched all the petitions that had been given to him on the way to the Senate House. "Read through them for me, will you? See if there's anything so important that I should attend to it before we leave." Mito took the petitions, nodded, and was off. Caesar continued up the steps, with Antony on his right, Decimus on his left, and me a step behind. Suddenly, Cinna was beside me.
"I just passed your son, who made me promise to stay close and look after you today, and so I shall."
"Take heart, Gordianus. Really, old fellow, you look like a ghost, or like a man who's seen a ghost." I tried to smile. Coming rapidly up the steps behind us, I saw a figure in a dark green tunic, conspicuous amid so many white togas. By his red beard, I recognized Artemidorus, whom I had seen at the house of Brutus and Portia, the tutor of their young son. Artemidorus's father had taught Caesar, I recalled, which perhaps explained the man's boldness in approaching Caesar at that moment, only a few steps from the entrance of the Senate House.
"Caesar," he called. "Caesar, please, I have something for you."
Decimus turned around and stiffened, as if he feared some threat. But all that Artemidorus held in his hand was a small piece of parchment, rolled tightly like a scroll. Caesar also stopped and turned to face Artemidorus, who now stood a step below me and Cinna, panting as if out of breath.
"Please, Caesar, take this."
Caesar saw the parchment. "Go find Mito, Artemidorus. There he is, just past the altar. He'll take that from you, and put it with the other petitions. But this is for your eyes only, Caesar."
"Then tell Mito not to read it. Tell him to leave it rolled up until he can give it to me."
"No, no, Caesar, you must read it now." Decimus scowled. Looking past him, I saw Brutus and Cassius huddled beside a column at the top of the steps, gazing down at the scene. Cassius's face was a blank, but Brutus looked acutely uncomfortable. Was he embarrassed to see his son's tutor make a spectacle of himself? Decimus reached past me toward Artemidorus, as if to repel him, but Caesar raised his hand to intervene.
"No, Decimus, leave him alone. I shall take the thing if he insists. Gordianus, you take it from him and hand it up to me."
Artemidorus reluctantly pressed the scrap of parchment into my hand.
"Let Gordianus keep it for you," said Decimus, sounding strangely insistent. Antony looked faintly amused. Caesar glowered.
"Stop this fussing, Decimus. Hand it to me, Gordianus."
I looked down at the parchment. I felt a sudden impulse to unroll and read it. I hesitated, and almost did so, but Caesar, sensing my presumption, snatched the scrap from my hand.
"Now be off, Artemidorus," he snapped. "Caesar, please, read it at once."
Caesar paused. He studied Artemidorus for a moment. He started to unroll the parchment. Then we were all distracted by the sudden arrival of a man who grabbed Antony's shoulder and shouted,
"Antony, Antony, I've been looking everywhere for you."
"Trebonius," said Antony, a bit tentatively, as if neither sharing nor comprehending the man's enthusiasm.
"Antony, I haven't seen you in a Titan's age. Listen, there's something we must talk about before the Senate convenes."
"Yes.
Stay behind, just for a moment. No need to make the dictator more tardy than he already is."
Trebonius smiled at Caesar. Caesar smiled faintly in return, then nodded to Antony, granting permission for him to leave his company. Cinna, observing my wrinkled brow, whispered in my ear, "Trebonius and Antony are old comrades in arms. They go back to the Battle of Alesia."
"Seems fonder of Antony than Antony is of him," I said as Trebonius led Antony down the steps.
"Probably wants a favour, like this pest," whispered Cinna, who then grunted as Artemidorus attempted to step past him.
"Artemidorus, enough of this," said Caesar sharply. He made a gesture with one hand that brooked no argument. In the other hand, he clutched the rolled parchment, now somewhat crumpled. "I shall read your message the moment I'm settled in my chair."
"Yes, Greek, desist," Decimus said sharply, placing a hand on Caesar's shoulder and leading him onward up the steps. Cinna followed close behind, but I hung back, seized by sudden, acute curiosity. As Artemidorus turned to go, I grabbed his arm.
"What's in the message?" I said.
His face was impossible to read, but he was clearly experiencing some desperate emotion. Anger, sorrow, fear.
"Not your business," he whispered. "Just tell Caesar to read it, now. Before he sits on that throne, he must..."
"His golden chair is not a throne," I said, trying to make light of his insistence. "Only kings have thrones." Ignoring me, Artemidorus turned and practically ran down the steps, taking two at a time, never looking back. His dark green tunic vanished amid the toga-clad crowd ascending the steps.
"How very strange," I said to myself.
I turned around and looked upward to see the reactions of Cassius and Brutus, but they had both disappeared, as Caesar was about to do, having taken the final step. Decimus still touched his shoulder, escorting him. Cinna was a step behind them. I hurried to catch up. Why was Artemidorus so insistent? Why had he disappeared so quickly, with such a look on his face? Was the Greek tutor trying to beg Caesar for a favour, or trying to warn him? And of what? Of whom? My heart lurched in my chest, because I was an old man walking too quickly up a flight of steps, I told myself. My vague apprehension was nothing more than a distraction I was foisting on myself to quell the anxiety I felt as the moment of my induction drew ever closer. My dread of that moment was a source of my uneasiness, not Artemidorus and his message, or the mortified look on Brutus's face, or Antony's sudden absence.
or Decimus's single-minded determination to shepherd Caesar into the Senate House. I hurried up the steps, my heart pounding in my chest. Ahead of me, I heard Caesar laugh as he entered the Senate House. Chapter 34. Even as Caesar was passing through the wide doorway, I stepped past Cinna and attempted to draw next to Caesar, but Decimus quickly stepped between us as if intentionally to keep me from him. Perhaps it was customary for one of Caesar's intimates to assume the task of delivering him to the Senate House, escorting the dictator every step of the way to his golden chair. Otherwise, Caesar would never get there, dogged by petitioners and well-wishers at every turn. Antony, as consul, was probably supposed to be doing Decimus's job, but Antony had been distracted and taken aside. I felt Cinna's hand on my arm.
"Gordianus, calm yourself. Take a deep breath. I fear those steps have winded you."
"I'm all right."
"Are you? Your face is quite red. I've never seen you in such a state. Have you let Artemidorus distress you? The Greeks, bless them, do have a way of injecting drama into every situation. The man's a mere tutor, you know, not even a poet, making a fuss over nothing, I'm sure."
Side by side, we entered the vestibule of the Senate House of Pompey. The walls and the floor were covered with a sort of marble I had never seen before, yellow, veined with black. The space was dominated by a very large painting, so famous that even I had heard of it, though I had never actually seen it. It was called The Warrior with a Shield Ascending by Polygnotus of Thasos, brought to Rome by Pompey after one of his successful campaigns. The painting was more than 300 years old, but looked as if the dazzling paint was still fresh on the wood. Against a black void, the warrior, naked, except for a Greek helmet, appeared to be suspended in mid-air. His arms and legs were outstretched, and his head tilted up, as if he gazed heavenward. In one hand he held a sword. On his other arm, thrust toward the viewer so that he dominated all else, was a shield covered with intricate designs and fabulous images of gods and monsters, as finely detailed as the famous shield of Achilles in the Iliad. For a moment I was distracted from all other concerns, my attention riveted on a famous work of art few men in the world were privileged to see, due to its location. Caesar, too, paused to look at it, though he must have seen it many times before. He looked back at me.
"What do you think, Gordianus? Is the warrior ascending, like Hercules, to join the gods on Olympus? Or is he plummeting from some great height, heading straight for Hades as he gazes toward the heavens?"
I stared at the painting. It hadn't occurred to me that the warrior must be dead. Caesar laughed.
"Still, he's either going up or down. How Pompey loved this painting! How generous he was to share it with his fellow senators!"
He moved on, with Decimus beside him. Cinna and I followed them through another doorway and into the main chamber. I sucked in a breath, struck by the loftiness of the ceiling. From windows high in the walls, a diffuse golden light illuminated a milling sea of white and red. The number required for a quorum, if I remembered correctly, was 200, and I judged there must be at least that many senators already in the room, with more arriving every moment. The tall chamber resounded with the echoes of many voices. The hubbub grew louder as the dictator's arrival was noticed. Caesar steadily made his way through the crowd. Decimus fended off any interruptions from the right,
while Caesar himself declined any demand for his attention from the left, holding up the parchment from Artemidorus, as if to show that he had already received enough petitions for the day. Among the senators I saw Cicero. He stepped back and bowed his head slightly as Caesar passed, and in return received a slight nod from the dictator. As I walked past him, Cicero gave me a baleful stare. "I saw that," said Caesar, looking over his shoulder. Cicero looked chagrined. Turning back for a moment, Caesar said to me in a low voice, "It was worth making you a senator, I think, just to see that look on Cicero's face. Why, Gordianus, I put a smile on your face, a good omen at last. If I can put you at ease, finder, then surely I can charm even the most recalcitrant senators today." Caesar headed toward a raised platform at the far end of the chamber. On this dais, set atop a high pedestal, stood a statue of Pompey, the great commander's arm raised as if to greet his fellow senators. The figure was extremely lifelike, one of those statues that seem almost to breathe and to look back at you. His face bore an extraordinary likeness to its model. The sculptor had captured exactly the plump roundness of Pompey's face and the bland smile he bestowed on friends and enemies alike. The smile of a man who might be about to kiss you or kill you. The way the statue loomed above us on its pedestal, and its uncanny resemblance to a man I had seen beheaded, made it seem strangely monstrous. I shivered, at once fascinated and repelled by the image of Pompey. Many have thought that Caesar would remove this image of his vanquished rival and rename the chamber for himself. Instead, he had allowed both the name and the statue to remain. Mito called this a sign of Caesar's magnanimity in victory. It might also be that Caesar felt some lingering obligation to Pompey, and even affection for him, especially now that he was dead. As we traversed the long room and drew nearer to the looming statue, I saw Caesar gaze up and heard him mutter under his breath, "We meet again, old friend, but while you stand, I shall sit." Then Caesar abruptly stopped and turned his head, looking from one side of the dais to the other. "My chair," he said in a quiet voice, and then louder. "My chair! Where is my chair? Why is my chair not ready for me?" "I think," said Decimus, "that someone must have ordered it to be removed and put away, thinking you had decided not to come. It's far too valuable to be left out unattended, as you must agree. I'm sure it's being fetched, even as we speak. Oh, yes, look there, two slaves are bringing it in." The gilded chair was carried onto the dais, where the diffused sunlight from the high windows caused it to glimmer like a throne made of golden fire. Caesar stepped onto the dais. Decimus followed him. I hung back, not sure if it was proper for me to stand on the raised platform. Cinna stayed beside me, but a number of senators felt no compunction about stepping onto the dais. Among them I saw Brutus and Cassius, and also portly Casca, the man who had mistakenly given me directions to the house of Cinna the praetor. That other Cinna, too, I had seen among the senators in the chamber when we entered, scowling as on the day I had met him, and wearing his praetorian toga with a red border, but he was no longer in sight. A train of slaves entered the room, carrying leather barrels for storing scrolls. This seemed to be the usual procedure. No one took notice of them. These barrels were set along the far edges of the dais, and some of the senators moved toward them, as if eager to lay hands on some piece of proposed legislation. "Cinna," I said, "there's something odd
about those containers, don't you think?
Is there?
They look too heavy. The way the slaves carried them, they seem to contain something other than scrolls.
Slaves can make any burden appear heavy, even a pillow stuffed with feathers, said Cinna with a smile. I shook my head, not quite satisfied with this explanation. Then I saw two slaves set a small tripod table beside the golden chair. Perhaps it was Caesar's habit to take notes during the proceedings, for on the table I saw a wax tablet and a rather heavy-looking metal stylus with a sharp point for scraping letters in wax. The stylus had the unmistakable gleam of silver, a worthy instrument for a dictator's hand. Before he sat, Caesar picked up the stylus. Perhaps he had thought of something he wanted to write down, for he seemed about to put down the piece of parchment in his left hand, which would have allowed him to pick up the tablet. Then something distracted him, and he kept his grip on Artemidorus's message as well as a stylus, as he turned about and gazed over the noisy, crowded room. One of the slaves who had delivered the chair moved it, so that Caesar could sit without bothering to look behind him. The slave stepped back, out of the way. Someone in a toga took the slave's place and stood directly behind Caesar, as if stationed there.
"Are there always so many senators on the dais with Caesar?" I asked.
Cinna cocked his head. "No. But with Caesar about to depart, this is their last chance to pester him for favours. See how they keep their heads down and hands inside their togas, looking meek and respectful. Look, there's Tilius Cimber, the old reprobate. No doubt he's here to beg Caesar to recall his brother from exile." Cimber was a tall man, whose most noticeable feature was a very red nose, the sign of a hard drinker. He and a score of others swarmed about Caesar like flies around honey.
"Soon enough he'll shoo them all away and the meeting can begin," said Cinna. "As consul, Antony is the one who should call us to order. Where is Antony? He's not still outside, is he?"
Like Cinna, I turned and looked around the room, and so it was that I missed something that happened on the dais. But when I looked again at Caesar, seated in his chair, someone had grabbed hold of his toga. It was Cimber, whose back was to me. Beyond him, I could see Caesar's face. He looked at first puzzled and then angry. He seemed to be trying to rise from his chair, but Cimber clutched his toga so tightly that Caesar couldn't get up.
"What in Hades does that fool think he's doing?" said Cinna.
The strange battle of wills continued for a heartbeat, and then Cimber pulled at the toga so forcefully that it slipped from Caesar's shoulder, baring his neck.
"This is violence!" snapped Caesar, as if rebuking an outrage to his dignity.
Then I saw a figure behind Caesar. It was Casca. He seemed to exchange a look with Cimber, and raised his arm. In Casca's hand I saw a dagger.
Chapter 35. In such moments, time becomes attenuated. The normally stiff and unyielding stuff of reality is suddenly in flux. Many thoughts take place in the blink of an eye. One of these thoughts, briefly foremost in my mind, was this: where did the dagger come from? And the answer appeared in my mind at once. It had come from one of those heavy-looking leather drums, heavy because they were filled not with scrolls, but with daggers. While I stared at the dagger in Casca's upraised hand, at the peripheries of my vision, points of light flashed amid the crowd of togas on the dais, and I knew that these flashes
must be the glimmer of reflected sunlight on metal. There was not one dagger in Caesar's presence, but many daggers. Casca stabbed downward. If the blow was aimed at the vein in Caesar's neck, he missed, for Caesar jerked backward toward Casca. The knife struck Caesar's breast, cutting through layers of wool and striking flesh. Blood erupted at the sight of the blow, a dark stain on the purple wool that began as a small point and then blossomed to the size of a man's fist. Caesar whirled around in his chair and stabbed blindly with the stylus in his hand. The pointed instrument struck Casca somewhere, but whether it drew blood or not I couldn't tell. Casca yowled like a dog and sprang back, dropping his dagger. "Gaius!" he cried, the name of his brother. Caesar tried to spring up from the chair, but Casca's brother lunged forward and stabbed him in the ribs. Knocked from Caesar's hand, the stylus fell to the floor with a loud clang. Another blossom of dark red erupted on Caesar's toga. On his face I saw many emotions. Fear was not among them. Shock was there, and loathing, and anger. "Curse these Cascas!" he shouted. The brothers had always been Caesar's friends and allies. Perhaps he thought it was only the two of them who were attacking him, and was calling on the others to hold the brothers back. Instead, more men with daggers stepped forward. Caesar raised his hands to defend himself, but a frenzy of stabbing ensued. The repetitive motion made me think of augury chickens pecking at sacred grain, their heads bobbing up and down. So moved the flashing knives, as if powered by some mindless force of nature, up and down. Some of the senators struck no more than glancing blows, but others ripped wool and penetrated flesh with a sickening, slicing sound. Some failed to strike Caesar altogether, and some, to judge by the screams and shouts, accidentally struck each other. Somehow, Caesar managed to stagger to his feet, or else he was driven forward by blows against his back. Before my eyes, his purple toga became many shades darker, almost black, as blossoms of blood spread and merged into one another. On Caesar's face, I now saw a look of utter confusion. He seemed to be thinking what I was thinking. Can it happen so quickly? Could a man like Caesar, known to everyone everywhere, a man who had conquered nations, enslaved tribes, slaughtered entire cities, a man without fear or trepidation or doubt, seemingly incapable of error, a man as close to godhood as any mortal who had ever lived, could such a man be alive one moment and dead the next? It seemed somehow against nature that what I was witnessing could actually be taking place. For one instant, with a terrible jolt, I was certain that I truly was imagining what I saw. I felt utterly detached from my own senses, unmoored from the world around me. It was as if a trap door opened beneath my feet. But the next instant, with an even more terrible jolt, I knew that what I witnessed was entirely, horribly, irreparably real. "Will no one defend him?" I thought. "Where is Antony? Where is Decimus?" Then I saw that at least two senators on the crowded dais were shouting and waving their arms, begging the others to stop. But they were unarmed and vastly outnumbered. The assassins forced them off the dais at knife point. I turned my head and looked at the crowded chamber behind me. The men nearest to me saw what was happening, but farther back, toward the entrance, the crowd was still conversing and milling about, oblivious of the carnage. No one outside the Senate House of Pompey could yet know what was happening. Soon enough, everyone in Rome would know.
Eventually everyone in the world would know, but not yet. I thought of Mito. Had he managed to get into the gladiator show in the theatre? I imagined I could hear a distant eruption of cheering above the hubbub inside the Senate House. Then the noise inside the room began to change, as screams and cries of alarm broke out, like a bloodstain, knowledge of the events on the dais spread rapidly. "They kill Caesar!" someone shouted. "They're going to kill us all!" Who were the they killing Caesar? Who were the us they would kill next? Many other confused shouts and cries of panic echoed throughout the chamber. Amid the crowd I spotted Cicero. Tyro stood next to him, holding a wax tablet and stylus, while others turned and scuttled past them, heading for the exit. They both stood still, as if transfixed. On Tyro's face I saw a look of shock. On Cicero's face I saw something else. He was surprised, yes, but also delighted. There was no other word for it. He looked like a man whose wife has just given birth, or a politician who's just won an election. He opened his mouth and emitted a series of sharp, nervous laughs. He trembled and swayed. He was giddy with joy. I looked back to the dais. Cassius stepped forward and slashed awkwardly at Caesar, cutting his cheek. Blood spurted from the wound. Caesar grimaced and staggered back. Then I saw Decimus. He had clung to Caesar at every step on the way to the golden chair. Where was he when the carnage began? No matter, he was present now. Was it too late for him to put a stop to the stabbings? Might Caesar yet survive, and this moment become another testament to his divine good fortune? If anyone could save Caesar, I thought, surely it would be Decimus. Then I saw the dagger in Decimus's hand. He lunged forward and stabbed Caesar's ribs, forcing him backwards so that Caesar collided with the golden chair, knocking it over. Cinna was as shocked as I was. He gripped my arm and gasped. Caesar staggered sideways. He collided with the pedestal of Pompey's statue. He leaned against it, barely able to stay upright. One at a time, senators lunged at him to deliver shallow stabs. They were like men taking turns to prove their commitment to some cause, then stepping aside to let another man do the same. Yes, I too shall stab Caesar, and I, and I, and I. The last was Brutus. He stood to one side. One of his hands was bleeding, apparently, from an unintentional jab he had received in the confusion. Cassius, next to him, stared at him sidelong and gritted his teeth. "Do it," he whispered. Brutus clenched his dagger and stepped towards Caesar. Caesar tilted his head and squinted his eyes. He shook his head. "Not you," he wailed. "Not you too, my boy." Without pausing, eye to eye with Caesar, Brutus stabbed low and hard, thrusting his dagger into Caesar's groin. When Brutus removed his dagger, Caesar slid downward, his back against the pedestal and his feet spreading before him. His toga was unwound and in shreds. The loincloth beneath was so loosened that it barely concealed his genitals. His mouth bubbled with blood that ran over his chin. Caesar gazed down at himself. Awkwardly, he gripped a fold of his toga with his right hand and tried to cover himself. Perhaps he was trying to staunch the wound made at his groin by Brutus, which gushed with blood. Caesar's eyes rolled up.
His arms fell to his sides. His body slumped, his left hand still clutching the note given to him by Artemidorus, opened so that the little scroll rolled onto the floor. The assassins surrounding Caesar all took a step back. They stared at their handiwork. Some looked appalled, others jubilant.
"We've done it," said Cassius. "We've actually done it."
Brutus raised both fists in the air, one bleeding and the other clutching his bloody dagger. "The tyrant is dead," he shouted. "Long live the Republic!" Others joined in the cry. "Long live the Republic!" They were shouting to an empty chamber. Even before Caesar was dead, the retreat of their fellow senators had become a stampede. No room had ever been emptied of so many occupants in so short a time. So much for the steadfastness of the Roman Senate. Men loyal to Caesar feared they would be next to die. Men sympathetic to the assassins also fled, being unarmed and having no idea what might happen now. Even Cicero had vanished. Brutus looked disappointed, like a man ready to make a speech who suddenly has no audience. "Where in Hades have they all gone?" he muttered. "Cowards and sycophants, every last one of them," said Decimus. "They have the courage of slaves." "Never mind. We shall make our arguments directly to the people under the open sky," said Cassius. "The citizens of Rome will rejoice now that the dictator's dead. They will welcome the gift of liberation with open arms. Mark my words, Lepidus and the rest of Caesar's lapdogs will be as meek as lambs once they see the mood of the city. Watch out, or they'll try to take credit for the tyrant's death themselves." I saw Gaius Casca stare at Cinna and then at me. "What about these two?" he said. "Perhaps we should kill them as well," said his brother. "And Antony, don't forget Antony," said Cimber. "We discussed this already," snapped Cassius. "We are not going to kill Antony or anyone else unless they give us just cause." He looked askance at Cinna. "We are certainly not going to kill Rome's foremost poet, never mind his slavish devotion to the dictator." "What about the other one?" said Cimber. "The upstart in the toga." Brutus stepped toward me. "It's certainly tempting. Do you want to know a secret, Finder? I hesitated for a long time before deciding to throw my lot with these brave men. I was torn. I suffered an agony of indecision. Do you want to know what made up my mind? It was the idea that Caesar was going to put the likes of you in the Senate. Gauls and Etruscan soothsayers were bad enough. But Gordianus, the Finder, Senator of Rome, that was the last straw. Well, you can take off that toga and leave it right here. You shall never be a senator now." I took a deep breath. I straightened my back and felt the weight of the toga on my shoulders. Instead of retreating, I stepped onto the dais. I met Brutus's gaze as I passed him and strode toward the pedestal where Caesar's body lay slumped. I looked up at Pompey's statue. How dignified the great one looked, the stately pose, the lofty brow, the enigmatic smile. Then I looked down at Caesar. How common and tawdry he looked, like any other court. Even the brightest flame leaves behind only cinders. Flies had already found a patch of blood next to the scroll that had slipped from Caesar's fingers. I knelt down, flicked the flies away, and picked up the little scroll.
It was smeared with blood. No one saw me take it, or if they did, no one cared. I returned to Cinna and took his arm. We began the long walk across the chamber